Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. We're here to empower people. Today, are statin drugs the cause of widespread decline in brain function? Have some very interesting insights from Dr. Duane Graveline, and also Dr. David Brownstein on that. We've all heard the myth that chocolate causes you to get fat. But some new science on this shows just the opposite, that eating chocolate burns belly fat and improves your cholesterol. A separate study also shows that there's good scientific evidence that chocolate, the flavanols in chocolate, improve cognition. There's a major university in Italy who just did a study on that. Nearly 1 in 5 women who undergo hysterectomy may need to reevaluate why they did it, because they didn't need it. It's not a needed procedure, according to the University of Michigan, in at least 20% of the cases. Resveratrol, found in grapes, protects the DNA, cuts the risk of heart disease and cancer. Now, that's good. So if we're eating grapes or drinking grape juice, we're getting the benefits. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program is Professor James Kilgore. Professor Kilgore is a community activist and a popular professor at the University of Illinois, where he's been teaching on global and African studies. Last year, Professor Kilgore was expelled from the university under the weight of right-wing media attacks. Well, following a campus-wide campaign by the faculty and students and supporters, his teaching position was reinstated. Today, he'll be on talking about the urgent need for an overhaul and reform of our prison system, both state and private. Also today, a commentary on why journalism is so bad. John Pilger from Alternet. Also, we're going to take a look at the Steven Anderson, the ex-New York City cop, who said that he planted evidence along with a lot of cops and was supported by a supervisor to frame innocent people to reach quotas. It's not a few rotten apples. And we'll talk about that and ask for feedback on that. Also, are you aware that the newest research from the Association for Psychological Science shows that people can be convinced they committed a crime they never did commit in as little as 3 hours of conversation? Wow. And also, a commentary today, the Law and Working Class History Association, Sam Mitrani, the police were created to control working class and poor people. Well, this is interesting. We'll examine that. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. As you know, I'm an advocate of people consuming living foods, antioxidant-rich foods, but also what are called superfoods. There are simply certain foods like the apple or grapes or tart cherries, goji berries, that are extremely beneficial. They go above and beyond what is normal for a vegetable or fruit to do in the body. For example, the green vegetables do a lot of good at purifying, cleansing the blood, rejuvenating the blood, being able to detoxify and chelate out heavy metals like lead, cadmium, mercury, whereas the fruits, especially the superfruits, they actually help in rejuvenating. So a combination of the two means that we can be healthier and rejuvenate. This is the latest study on resveratrol, which is the nutrient in grapes. It protects the DNA, hence it's protecting your gene. And that means that you're at a lower risk of heart disease and cancer and diabetes. And it even helps with weight loss. Now, you do get it from drinking wine, but I would say wine would be the last resource because it has the smallest amount in it. Far more you get from eating grapes, and even more you get from drinking grape juice, and there's organic grape juice. Even more is grape concentrate, about 300% more, because they evaporate out water, giving you greater concentration, and most of all is the grape powder that gives you the highest concentration. This is from the Mayo Clinic, and they found, quote, that despite its possible health benefits, doctors are leery of recommending a wine to patients where overconsumption can lead to health problems. That is true. They also are not keen on addressing issues of health and disease when it comes to nutrition. But here the science is strong. There are over 3,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on resveratrol, which mimics naturally occurring amino acids that protect us from genetic damage. So, and that's very important. So get your resveratrol, drink your grape juice, eat the grapes, get it into your system. Also, we know that there are too many medical procedures, not done because it's necessary to do these medical procedures in order to tell how to better help you, but because of defensive medicine. That means that you could be getting very invasive tests simply because they don't want to have you sue them and say, oh, you overlooked something, you didn't find something because you didn't do enough testing. So we're over-tested, massively over-tested. It is called defensive medicine. We're also over-medicated for the same reason. Because as long as a physician is giving us a medication based upon a schedule or based upon what can be accepted from current medical practice, you can't win in a lawsuit against them. It'd be very hard. As long as that doctor is doing what is called current standard of medical practice. But if a doctor wanted to be more conservative and say, let's not start with the drugs, let's start with lifestyle and behavior modification, and then if you improve, we'll continue. If you don't, then we can go to drugs. And if you don't improve, then you sue the doctor, and the doctor then is in trouble. So we are really in a catch-22. What is the solution? I think it's simple. No-fault medical care, where each doctor and hospital pays a relatively small amount of their practice, maybe 1%, into a common fund, and the common fund has a schedule of what they will do to help anyone who has been legitimately injured and therefore has to be made whole or helped, or is incapacitated and therefore has to be compensated for what they're not able to earn. That's completely legitimate and reasonable. That way, no doctor will end up going broke and stopping the practice of medicine because of the huge fees they pay each year in malpractice insurance. It would also stop a lot of the foolish claims that occur, which is a lot. So that would be my suggestion. Now, this is from the University of Michigan. Quote, it is estimated that 1 in 3 women in the United States will have had a hysterectomy by the age of 60. Although the numbers of hysterectomies are decreasing, a new study of more than 3,000 women in Michigan who underwent hysterectomy for benign indications revealed that alternatives to hysterectomy are being underused and the treatment guidelines are often not followed. Post-surgical pathology showed that nearly 1 in 5 of hysterectomies that were done for benign indications were unnecessary, and that nearly 37% of women under the age of 40 had unsupportive pathology. It means they should not have had that. So you're dealing with over 100,000 women a year in the United States. This was published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. This is one of the reasons that I believe we're going to have something new. And I'm working now with some physicians who are more idealistic and more compassionate to work with patients in actually visiting a physician specialist to be there as the patient advocate. Meaning, the doctor says that you have an image in the breast and wants to do a biopsy or possibly wants to do a lumpectomy. You have a physician there who examines the information, does some research, and says, I disagree. This could be a non-cancerous mass, and there's no reason for engaging in some form of mutilation and all the expense and the pain, secondary infections, etc. Or may say, after looking at all the evidence, I would concur. I believe that we need patient advocates, where you actually have to have a doctor go with you to see a doctor so you're not overtreated, overdiagnosed, misdiagnosed, or killed. And if you think that that's an overstatement, a hyperbole, the number one cause of death in the United States for years has been iatrogenic medicine, meaning medically induced death, preventable death, and the number one cause of injury. If you took all of the injuries, car accident injuries and biking injuries and home injuries, medicine injures more people by at least one magnitude. So we need advocates. So a lot of women, before you get your hysterectomy, get a second opinion from a holistic doctor, because we've seen a lot of women who, when they were able to change their lifestyle and radically change their diet, change the underlying conditions that lead to having to have a hysterectomy. There's mounting evidence demonstrating that you could actually improve brain function substantially from cocoa. And that's where we get our chocolate. Now, I'm talking about getting the really high-quality organic chocolate, fair trade chocolate. And there's a chemical in there. It's called a flavanol. Now, this is from the University of L'Aquila in Italy. Quote, it is normal for cognitive function to slightly deteriorate with age. Memory capacity begins to worsen along with processing speed and the ability to form long-term memories. Finding a way to defer the onset of these issues becomes increasingly important as life expectancy gets longer and global populations age. This study, conducted by researchers at Italy's University of L'Aquila and Mars, reinforces the results of several recent cognitive studies, throwing more light on the important role of diet in maintaining cognitive health. A Dr. Desideri, lead author of the paper, said, quote, the results of this study are encouraging. They support the idea that diet, and specifically a diet rich in cocoa flavanols, can play an important role in maintaining cognitive health as we age. Well, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension. So what did the outcome show? It showed those who consumed chocolate each day in a reasonable amount had a substantial benefit in cognitive function. And this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. So my suggestion is have chocolate, but without the dairy, without cream and all that processed sugar, and just have healthy chocolate. And there's a gazillion healthy chocolates on the market now. And so if you know someone who has memory loss, cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, I would suggest 100 grams a day. Now, 28.35 grams to an ounce, so you're talking about, you're only talking about around little under 3 ounces. It's a small amount, very small amount. Now, a second myth is the primary myth that chocolate didn't have any benefit. The second myth, well, it caused you to be fat. According to the peer-reviewed European Review of Medical and Pharmacological Sciences, just the opposite. They did a very detailed study, and this was done at the Department of Neuroscience, Division of Human Nutrition, University of Vergata in Rome, and the a scientific paper called Effects of Dark Chocolate, that's your healthy chocolate, in a population of normal weight, obese women pilot study. describe the effects of 100 grams, there's your 100 grams, of dark chocolate taken for 1 week, that's 3-ounce bar, in so-called normal weight obese syndrome subjects. And they found that it improved biomarkers for interleukins, it improved blood pressure, and it actually improved a reduction in the what is called the abdominal circumference or body fat, your belly fat. So, not only is it a myth that the chocolate makes you fat, I guess if you ate the commercial kind and all the dairy and sugar, you certainly could get fat. But if you ate the healthy kind, you actually benefit substantially, including losing weight and belly fat. And finally, there is a article that I read about statins. Now, I'm opposed to statins. I do not see the science that is legitimate showing that they improve the quality of life and long-term survival. We know that we have a lot of aging baby boomers and their parents, senior citizens, and they're suffering from malfunctioning, inflammation, damage to the brain. We see it in memory loss, cognition problems. And then they're given a diagnosis that there's nothing can be done. But no one's ever pointed the finger at pharmaceutical drugs taken earlier in life that caused that brain damage. So now we're going to put evidence out there that the statins are a cause of brain misfunction. Now, that's a strong statement. And there are known studies that no one pays attention to that show this. There is a book called Lipitor, Thief of Memory, by Dr. Duane Graveline, a medical doctor, and he wrote about his own horrific experience with statins and how they caused him to suffer two transient global amnesia events as well as chronic neuropathy. The former astronaut and aerospace medical research scientist explains how these traumatic events were the direct result of statins altering his brain. Now, he has a good friend named Dr. David Brownstein, also highlighted the mechanics behind this damage on his blog. And he pointed out that statins work by poisoning an enzyme known as HMG-CoA reductase. In lay language, that's just the body uses this to produce cholesterol and adrenal hormones and sex hormones and memory proteins. Well, this HMG-CoA reductase is also responsible for maintaining cell energy, which is needed by every system of the body. So artificially blocking or otherwise inhibiting this vital enzyme is a recipe for health disaster, which is why Dr. Brownstein advises against anyone taking statin drugs. He also questions why any doctor would prescribe them, knowing that as many as, around 4 million people have reported brain dysfunction as a result of their use? 4 million. Quote from his book, "You can't poison a crucial enzyme or block an important receptor for the long term and expect good results." End quote. Now, based upon the thousands of entries published in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Adverse Events Database, statin drugs have been linked to everything from short-term memory loss and disorientation to chronic depression and dementia. Now, these same databases report well over 100,000 adverse events in other areas as well, which, now, based upon the 1 to 10% reporting, meaning 99% of the people who have an adverse effect will never get it reported. You're dealing with millions of people who have been harmed by statins. And I've reported on this program many times that statin use is linked to liver damage, kidney poisoning, muscle pain and degradation, heart failure. From Dr. Brownstein, quote, "Perhaps we could live with all these adverse drug reactions if statins significantly lowered the risk of cardiovascular disease, but they don't." Quote, "Statins have never been convincingly shown to prevent a first heart attack in both men and women. In men, the best of the statin studies show 1% to 4% reduced risk of preventing a secondary cardiac event. In women, the numbers are worse, end quote. So, what we have is we have worthless drugs that are also dangerous. They don't work for the underlying condition they're prescribed for, but they do cause lots of danger. From Dr. Mark Hyman, quote, these drugs frequently cause muscle damage, muscle cramps, muscle weakness, muscle aches, excess exercise intolerance, and sexual dysfunction, liver and nerve damage, and other problems in up to 15% of patients who take them. They can also cause significant cellular, muscular, nerve injury, as well as cell death in the absence of symptoms, end quote. And yet on television, think of all the times you've seen hundreds and hundreds of ads for statin drugs. We shouldn't have them at all. So be aware, statin drugs are worthless, dangerous. They're a medical fraud. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break. And by the way, tomorrow, how organic micro farms, micro meaning minimal, small, are changing our food supply for the better. Good news on what we're looking at in small organic farming coming tomorrow. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Get down, tell me, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down? What you gonna do? You wanna get down? What you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
Tell me, how you gonna do it if you really don't wanna dance? By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
'Cause I heard all the people saying,
get down on it,
come on in.
Get down on it.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. In a few moments, we'll be talking with Professor James Kilgore on the urgent need for an overhaul and reform of our prison system. It's needed badly. However, one of the reasons that we have such a decrepit, corrupt, and profit-driven prison system, it's not about justice. All the studies show that when you incarcerate people, you're doing it to punish them, not rehabilitate them. And what of all the innocent people in our prisons? What about all the people who should never have been there? What about all the false arrests? People think that these are insignificant in numbers. They are extremely significant in numbers. But what happens when you're in the prison system itself? We're going to explore that with my guest in a few moments. I'm concerned about how bad journalism has been. There are certain media I simply will not turn on. I will not, under any circumstances, watch MSNBC. I can't watch Fox. I will not listen to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity. In fact, NPR I refuse to. I'd rather take an ice pick in my brain because of Wonder Bread for the Brain from NPR. The imbalance, the lack of objectivity, the lack of hard-hitting journalism, the lack of critical analysis is palpable, the same for PBS as well. So there are very few places in America where you can actually tune in and hear something that is at least trying to be objective and honest. So why has so much journalism succumbed to propaganda? Why are censorship and distortion standard practice? Even the BBC, so often a mouthpiece of rapacious power. Why do the New York Times and the Washington Post deceive their readers? And they do regularly. Why are young journalists not taught to understand media agendas and to challenge the high claims and low purpose of fake objectivity? And why are they not taught that the essence of so much of what's called the mainstream media is not information, but power? The times we live in are so dangerous and so distorted in public perception that propaganda is no longer, as Edward Bernays called it, an invisible government. It is the government. It rules directly without fear of contradiction, and its principal aim is the conquest of we the people, our sense of the world, our ability to separate truth from lies. The information age is actually a media age. We have war by media, censorship by media, demonology by media, retribution by media, diversion by media. For me, it's a surreal assembly line of obedient cliches and false assumptions. But from a man who I respect greatly, John Pilger, it is more than that. Within a few years, driven by the forces of profit, the cult of meism had all but overwhelmed our sense of acting together, our sense of social justice, our sense of internationalism. Class, gender, and race were separated. The personal was the political, and the media was the message. Pilger filmed an interview in Washington with Charles Lewis, the distinguished American investigative journalist, in 2003. They discussed the invasion of Iraq a few months earlier, and Pilger asked, quote, "What if the freest media in the world had seriously challenged George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, investigated their claims instead of channeling what turned out to be crude propaganda?" He replied that if we journalists had done our job, quote, "there is a very, very good chance we would have not gone to war in Iraq." Now, that's a shocking statement, and one supported by other famous journalists like Dan Rather, formerly of CBS, gave the same answers. David Rose of The Observer and senior journalists and producers in the BBC. In other words, had journalists done their job, had they questioned and investigated the propaganda instead of amplifying it, hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children might be alive today, and millions might have fled their homes. The sectarian war between Sunni and Shia might not have ignited, and the infamous Islamic State might not now exist. Even now, despite the millions who took to the streets in protest, most of the public in Western countries have little idea the sheer scale of the criminal acts done by our government in Iraq. Even fewer are aware that in the 12 years before the invasion, the U.S. and the British government set into motion a holocaust by denying the civilian population of Iraq a means to live. Those are the words of the senior British official responsible for sanctions in Iraq in the 1990s, a medieval siege that caused the deaths of 500,000 children under the age of 5. That's reported by UNICEF. The official's name is Carney Ross. In the Foreign Office in London, he was known as Mr. Iraq. Today, he is a truth-teller of how governments deceive and how journalists willingly spread the deception. Quote, "We would feed journalists factoids of sanitized intelligence, or we'd freeze them out." And by the way, let us not forget for a moment that it was Hillary and Bill Clinton together as co-presidents who decided to implement the sanctions. And it was their go-to person, Madeleine Albright, who went on 60 Minutes, and when asked by Leslie Stahl, "Is it worth the death of 500,000 children?" she said, "Yes." "Really? And by what do you measure worth? What if it was your child? Would it still be worth allowing these innocent children to starve and to die of diseases of impure water?" But that is what the media chose not to focus on. The main whistleblower during this terrible silent period was Dennis Halliday, then Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and the senior UN official in Iraq. Halliday resigned rather than implement policies he described as genocidal. He estimates that sanctions killed more than 1 million Iraqis. What then happened to Halliday was instructive. He was airbrushed, or he was vilified. On the BBC's Newsnight program, the presenter, Jeremy Paxman, shouted at him, quote, "Aren't you just an apologist for Saddam Hussein?" The Guardian recently described this as one of Paxman's, quote, memorable moments. Last week, Paxman signed a contract to write a book on this. The handmaidens of suppression have done their job well. Consider the effects. In 2013, a Romrus poll found that a majority of the British public believed the causality toll in Iraq was less than 10,000, a tiny fraction of the truth. A trail of blood that goes from Iraq to London had been scrubbed almost clean. Rupert Murdoch is said to be the godfather of the media mob, and no one should doubt the augmented power of his newspapers, all 127 of them, with a combined circulation of 40 million in his Fox network. But the influence of Murdoch's empire is no greater than its reflection of the wider media. The most effective propaganda is found not in the Fox News channels, but beneath a liberal halo. When the New York Times published claims that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, its fake evidence was believed because it wasn't Fox, it was the New York Times. The same is true of the Washington Post and the Guardian, both of which have played a critical role in conditioning their readers to accept a new and dangerous Cold War. All three liberal newspapers had misrepresented events in Ukraine as a malign act by Russia, when in fact, the fascist-led coup in Ukraine was the work of the United States, aided by Germany and NATO. This inversion of reality is so pervasive that Washington's military encirclement and intimidation of Russia is not contentious. It's not even news, but suppressed behind a smear and scare campaign of the kind that we have not seen since the Cold War. The suppression of the truth about the Ukraine is one of the most complete news blackouts in the immediate history. The biggest Western military buildup in the Caucasus and Eastern Europe since World War II is blacked out. Washington's secret aid to Kiev and its neo-Nazi brigades responsible for war crimes against the population of Eastern Ukraine is blacked out. Evidence that contradicts propaganda that Russia was responsible for the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner is blacked out. And again, supposedly liberal media are the censors. Even on Pacifica, there are popular morning radio shows that were the cheerleaders. In my opinion, and I'll tell you personally, I will not separate out the work of Judith Miller for the New York Times, pounding the drums for war for America and others to go into Iraq, as I would for one popular radio journalist pounding the drums for war to invade Libya and later Syria. And yet there is gross, manifest censorship in Pacifica. Manifest. You dare touch a trip line to tell the truth, and if it affects someone in a political position, you will be dealt with harshly. And yet, we're supposed to be the bastions of freedom of speech. Well, you can set that mockery and shame aside. For those of us who know the truth, challenge us, and we will share it. Many in the Western media have worked hard to present the ethnic Russian population of the Ukraine as outsiders in their own country, almost never as Ukrainians seeking a federation within Ukraine and as Ukrainian citizens resisting a foreign orchestrated coup against their elected government. What the Russian president had to say is of no consequence. He is considered the villain. 40,000 people at a border didn't happen, but you couldn't believe that from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Observer, the latter having previously distinguished itself with lies and fabrications that backed Tony Blair's invasion of Iraq, as its former reporter, David Rose, revealed. So, in the 19th century, the writer Alexander Herson described secular liberalism as, quote, the final religion, though its church is not of the other world but of this. Today, this divine right is far more violent and dangerous than anything the Muslim world throws up, though perhaps its greatest triumph is the illusion of freedom and open information. I'm Gary Nall. Before we take our break, I have Jason, our program director for the Progressive Radio Network, in studio. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Gary. How are you?
Good. You have some updated new numbers to start the new season. What are they?
Well, yeah. After finishing last year with amazing numbers on Facebook, over 239,603,000 people coming, reading our articles, looking at our pictures, watching our videos, listening to podcasts, we started out this last week amazing. We had over 20,163,000 people just read our post up there. We had 43,267 new people liking our pages and commenting on it. And 1,407,000 people actually talking to us and interacting with us on Facebook. And this is all just in the last week, the last 7 days. So that's an amazing, amazing number, and we keep hoping people come.
Also, listening over the telephone, yeah. And I haven't even given that number in a long time.
Yeah, I will do it for you, actually, because we're the sixth biggest station in the whole world, which they have over 4,585 stations. We have over 15,329,558 minutes, and that's not including the over 500,000 minutes we've accumulated just this month, which is 20 days in only. So that's an amazing number. Thank you for all the people listening. We really appreciate it, and just keep it up and keep passing the news around about Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That. Just letting people know there is a place for true and honest information, articles, documentaries, investigative reporting, calls to action, and community outreach, and we are sharing that. And I want to thank, I didn't know that we had 20 million people last week, but we thank all of you for coming and listening and sharing the information. And we've done all this without a single article, a single piece of publicity, nothing. So it shows that people power does matter, word of mouth does matter, and we will continue to share that. In just a moment, we will have our guest who is standing by. I was just told Professor James Kilgore, going to talk about our prison systems on the line. But we have just finished helping one of our sister stations that I've been on 38 years. It'll be 39 years in another month and 15 days. And raising money to help it in this hour of need. And we did a health retreat. And we don't have time today, but on the, one of the few days in the future, we'll give you some feedback from the people themselves. But there was an amazing amount of positive information. People's lives changed. So we want to thank all the people who came, and we'll let you hear from them, as well as Luann Panessi, who we'll be talking with on tomorrow's program because she was counseling all those people. So that event is over. It was great. People flew in from all over the United States, and San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago and to help. And so we had a wonderful experience. It raised thousands upon thousands of dollars for the station. The people had a great time, and we're happy that we did it. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by, Professor James Kilgore. I gave your background a little earlier, so nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Gary. How are you doing today?
Good. And we're looking forward to your forthcoming book, A People's Guide to Mass Incarceration, Understanding the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. Now, while there's a tendency to attack and criticize the privatization of prisons and incarceration, and surely private prison firms are reaping huge monetary rewards, the problems that continue to exist in the state prison that get overshadowed and overlooked. And with attention being placed more on the private prison firms, we easily forget the horrors taking place in the public penitentiaries, and hence we need to keep in mind that there is really only one prison culture, both government and private, and these work in unison with each other. So please take your time and speak on why we should also be equally concerned about state prisons and why they should undergo fundamental reforms. And then second, can you speak on some of the other myths you've observed that need to be debunked regarding our penal system?
Okay, well, when it comes to the private prison companies, I mean, we all love to hate them, and nothing seems in many ways more despicable than making money off of locking people up and making more money out of locking up more people for longer periods of time. But when we actually look at the U.S. prison system, we find that only 8% of the prison beds are controlled by private prison corporations. 92% are under the control of either the federal, the state, or local government. And I totally support campaigns against private prison corporations and efforts to halt their expansion. But at the same time, I think we need to remember that mass incarceration has been a state-driven project. It's been largely funded through state departments of corrections, through state budgets, and through local county budgets. County jail building and so forth has been a big part of this process. And this has been largely driven by both a political and an economic agenda. I mean, a political agenda is largely the shift from what we used to have, a system that focused at least to some extent on rehabilitation, on giving people second chances, and on providing some kind of training and education for people to prepare them to return to the streets, to a culture of punishment, where today we are locking people up and basically giving them very little to do. From my own experience of 6.5 years in both the federal and the state of California prison system, I can say that the big issue is that people are being warehoused, that they're not being given any kind of skills, they're not being given any kind of meaningful activity, and this is largely a political project in the sense that we are trying to solve social problems through punishment, through incarceration. Instead of building public housing, we're building prisons. Instead of providing jobs, we're deindustrializing and then locking up the unemployed people, overwhelmingly African-American and Latino, in the inner cities. We're solving racial conflicts by locking up the people of color who are no longer essential to the economy. So I think we have to recognize that there's this whole political agenda that's represented a major shift from the 1980s onward, and it's a political agenda that's been supported overwhelmingly by both Republicans and Democrats. Bill Clinton built more prisons during his years than Ronald Reagan. So this has been one of the few points that Democrats and Republicans have been able to agree on, and it's only recently that some of that is beginning to come unstuck. So I think that's a big piece, is that this is a political project. Yes, there's economic interests, but I think one of the myths is that it's all driven by the interests of private prison corporations, and that's simply not correct.
Let me add something on to this, and then I'd like for you to respond to what I'm going to read. If we look at the end stage, where the majority of mental patients in the United States are put into these jails, they have no capacity to help them. And a mental patient is going to act out. When they act out, they're then punished, put in solitary confinement. One man was burned to death, scalded to death in a New York prison. They're frequently beaten. Then you have people put in deep confinement, in solitary confinement, where every study shows that this is traumatic, creating post-traumatic stress disorder. And sometimes in southern jails, people have been put in there for decades. Now, this is from a Huffington Post article today from Trymaine Lee. Quote, a former New York City narcotics detective testified in court that planting drugs on innocent people was common practice, a quick and easy way to boost arrest numbers. According to the New York Daily News, the practice is known among New York City Police Department officers as flaking, and officers in Brooklyn and Queens narcotic squads were doing a lot of it. Stephen Anderson, a former detective who was snared along with a group of other officers for flaking four men in Queens back in 2008. He is now cooperating with prosecutors and spilling the beans on the crooked practice of framings and false arrest, often to reach arrest quotas. Quote, it was something I was seeing a lot of, whether it was from the supervisors or undercovers and even investigators, Anderson testified in Brooklyn Supreme Court last week. Quote, it's almost like you have no emotion with it, that they attach the bodies to it. They're going to be out of jail tomorrow anyway. Nothing is going to happen to them anyway, so they do it. The Drug Policy Alliance, a group that promotes alternatives to the war on drugs, issued a statement calling the case against the officers indicative of a larger systemic failure. Quote, one of the consequences of the war on drugs is that police are pressured to make large numbers of arrests, and it's easy for some of the less honest cops to plant evidence on innocent people. The drug war inevitably leads to crooked policing, and quotas further incentivize such practices. Now, the latest case isn't the first time corrupt police practices and number fudging by the department has been exposed. A few years ago, an officer also in Brooklyn began secretly taping the activity around the department and uncovered a more sinister side to city policing. Hundreds of hours of tape reveal how bosses threaten street cops if they don't make enough stop and frisk arrests, quote, but also tell them not to take a certain robbery reports in order to manipulate crime statistics. The tapes also refer to command officers calling crime victims directly to intimidate them about their complaints. So according to the DPA and the NYPD have recently come under fire because of more than 50,000 people arrested last year for low-level marijuana offenses. 86% of them are black or Latino, making marijuana possession the number one offense in the city. And just remember, marijuana was decriminalized in New York State in 1997, and that law is still on the books. So smoking marijuana in public or having marijuana visible in public, however, remains a crime. And most people arrested for marijuana possession are not smoking in public, but simply have a small amount in their pocket or purse or bag. So often when police stop and question a person and they ask, empty your pockets or open your bag, many people comply even though they're not legally required to do so. If a person pulls marijuana from their pocket or bag, then it is considered open to the public view and the police arrest them. So we're not even talking about what gets a person into the prison system and how corrupt that system is, how many innocent people are targeted, profiled because of their race or ethnicity or their income, poor people, how many homeless people are in jail because they have no place to live and they've now made being homeless a crime. So shouldn't we also include that into the discussion of the completely corrupt incarceration industry?
Yes, well, I think there's two important things. One, let's just go back to the mental health piece for a second. I mean, we have more people now locked up in jails and prisons with mental health issues than we do in state mental institutions. So we have about 350,000 more, about 13% of the people in the prison and jail system are people who are diagnosed with mental illness. And across the country, we're finding now that county and state officials are using this as a way to leverage further prison construction in order to build mental health units in prisons and in county jails. So this is kind of the new frontier for mass incarceration. And I know many people at local levels, including my own county, I live in a small county in central Illinois, we're fighting the plans of a sheriff to try to expand the local jail and spend millions on building a mental health unit when we have no mental health facilities in the community. So this is being replicated across the country, and it's part of the way in which state expenditure has shifted from social welfare provision to policing and corrections. And I think that connects up with your second point in the sense of the culture of police, the practice of policing is largely a result of the fact that we have empowered police to be the agents that supposedly address all these problems. The police are addressing the homeless issue by arresting people and providing them with housing in jails and prisons. The police are empowered now to clean the streets by harassing African-American and Latino, overwhelmingly youth, on the streets in the so-called war on drugs. And then on top of that, the local police forces are given huge grants of military equipment. These tank-like vehicles, armored personnel carriers, MRAPs, they call them, the kinds of things that were used on the streets of Ferguson. Local police forces are given free M16s, rocket launchers, a whole range of artillery that's completely inappropriate for local policing. So we're militarizing the police, and we're giving them more and more resources, and then we're giving, and then we're using those the policing as a way of raising money for local governments. And this is one of the things that also came out incredibly prominently in the case of Ferguson, where it was found out that traffic stops and traffic tickets were generating huge amounts of revenue for the city, and they were overwhelmingly targeting African-American people and costing them huge amounts of money, and particularly targeting the poor, for whom a fine of $150 or $200 may be unaffordable and may end them up with a jail sentence or a whole sequence of encounters with the criminal justice system that may cost them their job, their housing, and so forth. So we have a whole shift in the function of the state to support security and to support policing, and away from mental health, public public housing, substance abuse treatment, job creation, education. All of these things have lost funding while corrections and policing have been gaining resources.
Final question. We know now that the prison industry and the major corporations behind it are trying to give a sanitized view of the incarceration process. They're repackaging incarceration, calling it incarceration light, which provides the appearance that change is occurring, but you've done the investigation to show that it isn't. So please deconstruct these so-called reforms and explain to us the principle of this so-called carceral humanism that is being introduced into prisons.
Well, I think, yes, one of the things that's happened is the discourse put forward by corrections officials and by sheriffs has changed. So in the 80s and 90s and even the early 2000s, the discourse was one of being tough on crime, of promoting law and order. It was a culture of punishment that was being promoted. But now that discourse has kind of run thin. People are growing weary of hearing that, and people are not so supportive of extending more funding for building prisons and jails simply to be tough on crime. So what's happened is that the discourse has now changed to what I call carceral humanism. That is that prisons and jails become the sites where so-called development therapy are taking place. So, for example, the mental health jails is one case where prisons and jails are now repackaging themselves as providers of social services to those who have substance abuse problems, to those who have mental health problems, and building facilities to deal with those problems. Another type of facility is what we call gender-responsive jails and prisons. So these are institutions where women are incarcerated who are supposedly being given special, having their special needs met as women, different kinds of education, different kinds of therapy, perhaps different kinds of visiting facilities for families and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's still prison. And the vast number of these people that are being locked up, they don't need better conditions in prison. Not that conditions couldn't be improved, but more importantly, we need to get them out of that prison system. We need to be providing them with employment. We need to be providing them with substance abuse, treatment, mental health, access to mental health facilities, education and job training, all the kinds of things that can help them live a successful life on the street, not sinking more and more resources into corrections and into policing, which keeps the system of mass incarceration going.
Very much appreciate your input. Thank you, and I look forward to the new book.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My guest, Professor James Kilgore, K-I-L-G-O-R-E, the forthcoming book, A People's Guide to Mass Incarceration, Understanding the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. And I want to thank all the people listening for sharing the information. When I look at how disappointed I am in so many of the media outlets out there, how little honesty, objectivity occurs. And yet these are the people winning the Pulitzer Prizes, prancing around on television, And they self-censor, or they out-and-out lie. So look for the truth. There's a lot of good quality alternative sources. Alternet, Common Dreams, Consortium News. There's no shortage of places, and they have no budgets, so word of mouth makes a difference. Share the thoughts that are meaningful to you, and there's a whole lot of people sharing out there, and we, at least right now, are a lot more than what we've ever been before as far as the capacity to engage and to challenge. The best way to challenge authority is no longer support it. So when you take your money out of their banks, when you stop eating food from their stores, when you stop electing their politicians, when you stop watching their television or listening to their radio or buying their newspapers or magazines or going to their movies, that's power back to the people. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today, a U.S. Supreme Court case challenging government-subsidized housing segregation and the police chokehold. When is a lynching not a lynching?
Well, and by the way, did you hear the numbers earlier?
Which numbers?
Huh?
Which numbers?
You didn't hear the numbers? Let's ask Jason to come in and give you the new numbers for last week. This is just last week.
Okay.
There has been a quantum change.
Oh, this is great.
All right. I wanted you to hear these numbers. Jason, please share these numbers with Utrece.
So, Utrece, this is just from the last week. We had 20,163,173 post-red. We had 43,267 new people liking us on Facebook and Progressive Radio Network. And then we had 1,407,567 people commenting and talking with us about these articles, videos, pictures, and podcasts. So it's been a great week and amazing numbers and so far in the new year.
Fantastic. That's great.
Well, put it this
excellent.
Way. That's about 100 times bigger than all the Pacifica stations combined. So maybe someone over there ought to listen and learn a little bit. So
it's
we look forward
great.
To your
Congratulations.
Program.
We're doing fantastically well.
Yeah, we are. You now have an audience that's 5 times larger than at any of your 22 years on BAI in the afternoon with Talkback. So you're doing something right. People keep listening
think
every
so.
Day. Utrece Lead right now.
But you say, look, yeah, but don't touch, baby.